The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
It's the show that asks the questions you'd ask if you could.
Questions like,
do you carry that hijab in a man's size?
And hey, where'd you get those cool feather earrings?
Those answers right now.
Here's your host, Eric Metaxas.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, folks, it's a show about everything, which means that we're allowed to cover history. As you know, I enjoy history. I wouldn't call myself a history buff, just because I loathe the word buff. But, you know, I like history, and especially American history. We have in the studio, literally, quite literally in the studio with me, somebody by the name of David B. Woolner. And the reason he's here is because he's the author of a brand new book on FDR, which is history buff talk for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The Last 100 Days is the title of the book. The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. David Woolner, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be here.
Would you describe yourself as a history buff?
No.
No. I think that when I think of the word buff, I think of somebody in the buff, which is to say in the nude. And I don't want people to think of me that way, even in historical terms.
Well, I think of, you know, people buffing their cars on the weekend.
That's just as bad, yeah, with a chamois or a ShamWow. How did you, you know, whenever I see a book like this, I want to ask the first question is, how did you get to be an expert on FDR? And by the way, you are an expert on FDR. I can say that up front. You're not just someone who wrote a book on him. You've dedicated most of your life to his legacy. So how did that happen?
Well, I mean, in part, it happened somewhat by accident, as life sometimes takes us. I was interested in Anglo-American relations. I was interested in U.S.-British relations in the 1930s and 40s, particularly international history, diplomatic history. And I was doing my PhD at McGill University and came down to do a research trip to the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park, and ended up talking to the director of the library, who was interested in my thesis topic. And somehow in the course of that conversation, the idea came up to do a international conference marking the 50th anniversary of what was called the Second Quebec Conference. Churchill and Roosevelt met in Quebec City twice in the course of the Second World War. And given that I was in Montreal and given that I was at McGill.
So this was in the early 90s.
This was in the early 90s. 1994 was the anniversary year. And I took it from there. I was born in Minnesota, but of Canadian parentage, and did my master's and PhD at McGill. And then this kind of brought me into the Roosevelt world, so to speak. It's really been straight ahead from there.
Okay. And so most people would wonder, as do I, why focus on the last 100 days? I assume it's obviously his life and his presidency, since he died in his fourth term. Why focus on the last 100 days of FDR's life and term?
Well, as you know, FDR is famous for his first 100 days.
No, I did. I mean, you always hear the term the first 100 days, but I wouldn't have known necessarily that we got that from FDR. I didn't know where it had begun.
Well, actually, when Roosevelt assumed office on the 4th of March, 1933, in the midst of, you know, the absolute depths of the Great Depression, the United States was in the worst economic crisis of its history.
Let me just interrupt to say, why would he have started in March and not on January 20th, which is typically when we inaugurate our presidents?
Well, because when he was elected in 1932, there was this long period between November and March, which was the standard time for the president to be inaugurated. And if you recall, when President Obama was the president-elect, you know, the country and the world was in such anxiety about the financial crisis that people were already turning to President Obama almost the day after he won the election.
Right.
He had to remind people, excuse me, but I'm not president until January 20th.
Right.
And actually, both President Bush and President Obama deserve a great deal of credit for the cooperation that they undertook.
They were able to lead us into an eight-year-long recession.
Well,
just kidding. Oh, just kidding.
Okay.
Yeah, together. But, you know, imagine if only one of them had done it, then the recession might have been 4 years.
Right. No, there's a lot of parallels.
But in all seriousness, you mean to tell me that a decision was made in early 33 that he would be inaugurated at a different time, or you're saying that was the normal time?
No, early March would have been the normal time for the inauguration.
When did that change? I mean, you're a presidential historian.
Because of FDR. It changed because, as I was saying, the long period between the election of Roosevelt and the inauguration of Roosevelt was kind of a never-never land, where Hoover was basically trying to, you know, the banks were closing across the country. I mean, it was an extraordinarily difficult time. And given that long, what we call interregnum, after Roosevelt was inaugurated and in office, he instigated a new rule that said, you know what, the president should be inaugurated in January, January 20th.
I love this. I'm learning things. I never would have guessed that it was as late as Roosevelt that we instituted.
Yeah, and it was during those months between November and March that, you know, thousands of banks were collapsing across the country, you know, the Bank of Chicago, Bank of Illinois, the New York State Bank. I mean, they were all collapsing. So if you can imagine if President Obama had been elected in November and couldn't have come into office until March, what that would have been
like. You need a firm hand on the tiller, as it were.
And Roosevelt was very reluctant to cooperate with Hoover because, one, he wasn't president yet. He hadn't been sworn in. But I think more importantly, politically, with his political instincts, he did not want to be sort of tainted with the past.
Right.
And he wanted a complete fresh start.
Right.
Actually, the Emergency Banking Act that was put into place in 33 was largely a cooperative effort between the Treasury officials under Hoover and the people that Roosevelt brought in. So in that sense, they collaborated. But FDR himself, you know, he kept his distance.
Okay. So the title of your book is The Last 100 Days. But you're reminding us that the first 100 days of FDR in early 33 were kind of a thing. Now, and what was it about? Why did that term evolve?
Well, you know, with the country, you know, unemployment at 25% nationwide, but in cities like Chicago and Detroit, unemployment was over 40%, 50%. I mean, people were really frightened. You know, for better or for worse, and we can probably argue with economists forever why these things happened. But the free market system had essentially collapsed.
Right.
And so people were in a real panic. And in that emergency, in the next 3 months, Congress under FDR's leadership passed 15 major pieces of legislation.
Wow.
Including some of the, you know, for example, the Glass-Steagall Act, which lasted until 1998, but we still have federal deposit insurance. A lot of this stuff was actually called emergency legislation. And some reporter, I'm not even sure whether it was the New York Times, kind of noticed that this had all happened within 100 days. And what most people don't realize is that actually he was referring to the first 100 days of Congress, not to the first 100 days of FDR's presidency. It's kind of a moot point.
Yeah.
But it's important for me because it was something I struggled with the title, because the book really starts at Christmas. And 100 days after Christmas does not take you to April 12th, the anniversary of his death. But then as I was counting back from the opening session of Congress, which is January 3rd, the Speaker's gavel comes down to open the 79th Congress at noon on January 3rd, 1945. And exactly almost 100 days later, almost to the hour, FDR collapsed.
Lucky for you.
Lucky for me. So the book.
If he would have collapsed a day earlier or a day later, you'd be messed up, man. You wouldn't have a title. You would have really struggled with your conscience. What do I write? No, actually, that's extraordinary. So it's the last 100 days of the longest presidency in the history of our nation.
That's right. He was elected to an unprecedented 4 terms in office. And I've spent a lot of time in and around Franklin Roosevelt because I was for many years the executive director of the Roosevelt Institute in Hyde Park and now a senior fellow at the organization. And I have a close association with the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. And, you know, he's a very enigmatic figure. He doesn't take notes. He doesn't like things written down. He told his subordinates not to take notes during cabinet meetings, et cetera.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So he's a hard man to get to know. And what begins to happen is the more you learn about him, the more fascinated you become.
Wow. Well, we're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to David Woolner. The book is The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. We'll be right back.
You like freedom? I do. You like money? Well, I do too. If you like freedom and money, then you're going to love Freedom Checks. You see, over the next few months, an estimated $34.6 billion is up for grabs to anyone who stakes their claim. Yep, you heard that right. $34.6 billion. To get all the details, just go to www.claimfreedomchecks.com. Thousands of people are already lined up to cash in. Take Doug, for example. He's a 46-year-old from Joplin, Missouri, who's set to get a check for $24,075. And if Doug can do this, I've got a hunch that you can too. But here's the thing. If you want the chance to grab your full fair share of this $34.6 billion payout, you must have your ducks in a row by March 1st. So don't wait. Get over to www.claimfreedomchecks.com before the March 1st deadline. That's www.claimfreedomchecks.com.
Hi, I'm Victoria Hearst. My family's company, the Hearst Corporation, publishes a magazine aimed at young women called Cosmopolitan. Nicknamed Cosmo, it contains pornography that hurts kids. I oppose this and have asked the Hearst Corporation Board of Directors many times to label Cosmopolitan adult material so that it cannot be sold to anyone under 18. But the company has refused to do it. So now I have a campaign called Cosmo Hurts Kids. I'm working with legislators, law enforcement, and community groups to have all U.S. states' material harmful to minors laws enforced against Cosmo so that it cannot be sold to your kids. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation says Cosmopolitan magazine contains pornography and is harmful to minors. American Psychological Association studies prove that early exposure to sexualization has significant negative mental health consequences for underage girls. My website is CosmoHurtsKids.com. CosmoHurtsKids.com.
You know, I'm not a genius about money. I love my credit cards, and they love me. I was using them as a source of income, and then I got behind in my payments, and creditors were calling. I figured I had a problem, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I heard about Trinity, so I called and talked to a counselor. In half an hour, we worked out a plan. Now I've got one easy monthly payment, a lower interest rate, and I'm getting out of debt.
If you're in an endless cycle of paying on credit card balances that never seem to go away, then get ready for a toll-free number that will put you on a path to financial recovery. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees and over-limit charges, reduce your interest, and possibly improve your credit score. You'll save thousands. If your debt has you down, we should talk. Call 1-800-990-6976. That's 1-800-990-6976. Call 1-800-990-6976.
It was Jesus who first called his followers a city upon a hill, a light for all to see. Since then, John Winthrop, Abraham Lincoln, JFK, and Ronald Reagan have echoed those words for those who call America home. Join author and SRN radio host Eric Metaxas as he lifts up this message and headlines the 2018 Remember America Speaker Series, Friday, April 6th in Lancaster, PA. This special event, sponsored by Dayspring Christian Academy, reminds Americans of their unique heritage of liberty that is founded on biblical principles. Remember America brings to life the important ideas Eric captures in his book, If You Can Keep It. The Remember America Speaker Series with Eric Metaxas is Friday, April 6th at 6:30 p.m. at the Lancaster County Convention Center. Tickets and sponsorships are available by calling 717-344-5584 or go to dayspringchristian.com. dayspringchristian.com.
The sun went down, and then you feel him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, pappy's corn squeezing.
White lightning.
George Jones. I love George Jones. But we're talking about FDR. I'm sitting here across the desk in the studio from David Woolner. David, am I saying that even slightly correctly? Is it Woolner?
Yes, it is Woolner.
How would you know? It's your name. David Woolner, the author of The Last 100 Days. FDR, whenever I read anything about FDR, I want to go into that voice, that radio voice, FDR at War and Peace, because that's the way everybody spoke then on the radio. But so let's get into it. The Last 100 Days, what persuaded you, other than the, you know, the gimmick of the first 100 days and now the last 100, but what was it about these last 100 days that forms itself into a narrative, into a book?
Well, I mean, part of, as I was saying before, part of what intrigued me about Roosevelt, you know, working in and around his life and career for many years, is his determination to carry on in office. And, you know, in the fall of 1943, he went to the Tehran conference in Iran. Then he came home. He got the flu, bronchitis, and so forth. And he never really fully recovered. And his daughter, Anna, was very concerned about him. She kind of pressed his primary physician to get a full medical workup, and they discovered in March of 1944 that Franklin Roosevelt had was suffering from congestive heart failure.
Okay, so he knows he's dying.
Yeah, early stages. Early stages.
And how old, by the way, was he at this point?
He was 62.
Wow, not old. My gosh.
Yeah, well, he's a lifelong smoker, and he's also a man in a wheelchair. I mean, he contracted polio at the age of 39 and was never able to walk or stand unaided again. And so it's a really remarkable, you know, the doctors actually ordered him to reduce his workload to 4 hours a day. So if you can imagine the
You mean at this point in 44?
In 44. So if you can imagine a president of the United States trying to run a country in a global war on 4 hours a day, it was absolutely ludicrous, frankly. And he really never obeyed that order. But you see a kind of flurry of activity, particularly from his daughter Anna, who is a very important person in the book, who's desperately trying to get him to rest every time she can. But he's absolutely determined. And the other thing that's interesting about this period is, you know, there's this kind of anticipation, or let's put it this way, there's this kind of feeling in the contemporary world, in today's generation, well, by then the war's over. But it wasn't like that to the American people. It wasn't like that to the people of the world. And after the Normandy invasion in the summer of 44, the Allies suddenly in July and August swept across Northern Europe. They swept across France. And people said, well, the war might be over by Christmas. And then all of a sudden, you know, once we got up to the German border, things really changed. And then, of course, the real shock came December 16th when Adolf Hitler launched the famous Ardennes counteroffensive, which
it's
practically
not, it's not that famous because some of us haven't heard of it. No, actually, I have heard of it, but I don't think of it as the famous Ardennes. I guess my question is, because it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, to remind us of this history. So December 16th, 1944, we're really at the end. But you're saying that the Germans put up
a major counteroffensive. I mean, we had not actually entered Germany yet. The Russians had made tremendous progress that fall. They had fought their way up to the Vistula River by the end of August outside of Warsaw. Then they had by this point approached within the end of the year 30, 40 miles from Berlin. But even their position was much more precarious than people realized because they had a long northern flank that was really exposed, tremendous fighting going on in East Prussia and places like that. So – and we're not in Germany yet, you know.
The Americans, the Allies.
The Allies, which, by the way, speaking as a person of Canadian heritage, includes not only the British and the Americans, but, of course, the Canadian First Army is fighting alongside. And so, you know, by the time – you know, when you get this tremendous counteroffensive, which practically throws the Allies back into the sea, you know, it's a real shock. And the
Back into the Atlantic?
Back into the North Sea. I mean, it was –
into the North Sea. So, yeah. In other words, we're talking about I guess I'm trying to think what is up by the border there. We're
looking at an offensive that ran over the territory that kind of straddles northern France, Belgium, and Luxembourg. And okay. Hitler was able to take advantage of the poor winter weather, which grounded the Allied Air Force, which was our tremendous advantage. And so you know, not being able to fly air sorties, this counteroffensive pushed the Allies back over 60 miles.
Wow. And so this is December of 44. It's amazing.
And the casualty rate for that month was skyrocketed. I mean, there's 74,000 casualties in Europe alone among the Americans. And we're in the midst of a manpower shortage. So in other words, the end of 1944 is a period of war weariness among the public, of kind of anxiety about and when Roosevelt's going to give his State of the Union address, General Marshall sends him a memo and says, you know, we're about to enter the most difficult phase of the war. Mm. So it's not over. And yet, you know, here's this man who is physically exhausted. The other thing that I think is interesting about this time of his life was he was really, in many respects, quite ambivalent about continuing on in office. He used to say, I'm tired of being Exhibit A. He called himself Exhibit A. He was tired of being president. He wanted to go back to the Hudson River.
Well, let's face it. I mean, for a president to have a third term, much less be elected to a fourth term, it's unprecedented in American history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess I have to ask, if he's elected at the end of 32, so he's reelected in 36, November, and then he's reelected again
in 40.
In 40, and then he's reelected again now at the end of 44.
Right. So he's been in office 12 years.
Did he ever question whether that was something a president ought to do? Did he think he was setting a bad precedent?
It's a very good question. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt is an unusual man in many respects. He had tremendous confidence in himself. He it's interesting. He doesn't have the kind of ego that you would sort of think of. He's a kind of humble person.
Yeah.
If you go to Hyde Park, and I would urge everybody to go out and visit the Roosevelt Estate in Hyde Park, it's a very humble, kind of unostentatious place. The Roosevelts are not a showy people, even though they were people of wealth. So they like to live simply and uncomplicated lives. And I think but he also was very confident in himself and very ambitious for the country and wanted to kind of finish the great
right.
project.
I mean, if you find yourself in the middle of a war,
exactly.
I guess. Although I have to say, wait a minute, because it's in 40, we're not yet in the war.
No, but there was, you know, he's deeply involved in supporting the British. The summer of 1940 is really the critical summer of the Second World War. And many people would say the critical summer of the 20th century.
I just saw the movie
Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour, which is magnificent.
This is the summer that Roosevelt makes the decision to support the British over the objections of his chiefs of staff and his military advisors.
Right.
He sends Harry Hopkins and others to London, and they come back convinced that Britain's going to hold on. And so at great political risk, because remember, this is an election year, he takes the unpopular decision to, you know, give the British these 50 old destroyers and so forth and so on.
I didn't know that, and I think it's important for us to acknowledge that. That's a heroic moment in the life of FDR.
Very much so. I mean, just as much as Churchill's has his heroic moment of, you know, absolutely refusing to negotiate a peace with Hitler and to throwing the, you know, using the English language to, you know, essentially fight Hitler in that critical moment. Roosevelt, equally so, makes this critical decision that he's going to provide that support that the British need. And it's a very difficult decision politically because there's tremendous opposition to it in the country. And yet he manages to, for example, negotiate this 50 old destroyer deal, the destroyer for bases deal in the summer of 1940. Interestingly, the third term decision is the really controversial one. In other words, and Roosevelt, you know, kept his hands to his chest. He didn't really let people know what he was thinking until quite late. And then finally he makes the decision he's going to run for a third term.
But at that point we're in the middle of a war.
We're close to the end.
But
Eleanor Roosevelt is the one who goes to the Democratic Convention and issues this line, you know, this is no ordinary time. In other words, this isn't, it's exceptional. People understood that. But the country supported him and he went back in. So the 44 election, by contrast, it's not so controversial in the sense that he's already broken the precedent. People understand he wants to finish the war.
And when did we make it a constitutional amendment that one couldn't
After Roosevelt, the decision was.
How soon after Roosevelt?
I can't remember.
Yeah, but it's just, it's extraordinary because we know that Washington deliberately set this kind of precedent of,
right.
of limited executive reach in terms of time. And it's just, I'm just fascinated. I've never been able to speak to an FDR scholar until today. Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. We're talking to David Woolner. The new book is called The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace.
Brown eyes, you're beautiful, and my song's for you. I wrote this song that I'm singing just for you. If words could paint a picture.
Thinking about life insurance? What if you could make one free phone call and learn your best price from nearly a dozen highly rated price competitive companies? Well, that's exactly what happens when you call SelectQuote Life. For example, George is 40. He was getting sky-high quotes from other companies because he takes meds to control his blood pressure. But when I shopped around, I found him a 10-year, $500,000 policy for under $25 a month. I'm SelectQuote agent Dan Savino, and believe me, if SelectQuote isn't shopping for your life insurance, you're probably paying too much.
For a free quote, call 800-523-3771. That's 800-523-3771. 800-523-3771. Or go to SelectQuote.com. Since 1985, we shop, you save.
Get full details on the example policy at SelectQuote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
I'm just so upset. I'm having so much trouble getting to sleep, only to wake up in the middle of the night worrying all over again. I'm wearing down. There's no one I trust, no one I can open up to. But I've got to find someone I can talk to. I can't keep going on like this.
She found help, and so can you. We are Faithful Counseling, the world's largest platform for faith-based professional counseling. Our Christian counselors are all licensed, trained, and experienced, qualified and certified by the state board. But more importantly, we share your Christian values. Available 24/7 by text, messaging, phone, and video conferencing from the comfort of your own home. We'd like to invite you to try your first week free by going to faithfulcounseling.com and use the invite code word HELP. That's faithfulcounseling.com and use the invite code word HELP to get your first week free. Faithful Counseling. We're here when you need us.
Come and listen in to the radio station where the mighty host of heaven sing.
Turn your radio on.
Oh, yes, turn your radio,
turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of endless free.
Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
The radio's on. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. The radio's already on. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to hear the song, Turn the Radio On. I don't get it. But we don't have time to sort that out. I am talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt with an FDR scholar, David Woolner. The book is The Last 100 Days. David, again, welcome.
Thank you.
So much to talk about here. We were just talking about this idea of deciding to run for a third and then a fourth term. It's a wild thing. And I think a lot of people, you know, who take the way America has run since the beginning, you know, get frightened by that because you realize that when you don't have a rule there, you know, you could have somebody suddenly running for five terms and before you know it, there's corruption and there's, you know, right. it's a scary thing. So it is interesting to me that he was willing to do that or that he wanted to do that.
Yeah, I think so. But I also think it's interesting that the American people supported it. And I think, again, you have to cast your mind back to the desperate situation the country found itself in. I mean, Roosevelt exuded this confidence. He exuded this hope for the future. You know, he didn't instruct people to embrace their fears. He instructed them to banish their fears with that famous line, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And so people, you know, it's interesting. When Hoover was president, the letters coming into the White House were about 5,000 a week, and Roosevelt's 50,000 a week. And
wow.
They had to increase the staff from one person to 60 people to answer the mail. And
well,
people,
it's kind of – I mean, when I think of Roosevelt, I think of Reagan. There's just an affability – that's there.
Absolutely.
That you can't fake
and,
it.
And Reagan would acknowledge that. I mean, he voted for Roosevelt 4 times.
I know.
And actually was a big supporter of the Roosevelt Memorial. I mean, he's the one who actually made that happen.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In Washington. Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, it's a fascinating story. And I think one of the things that comes out in the book is that, you know, because the people had such great faith in him, and then because we transitioned from one great crisis, an economic crisis, now to a war crisis, Roosevelt ultimately decided that he probably should stay on, and the people supported that decision. He said, you know, Dr. New Deal is now going to become Dr. Win the War, in that wonderful way of his. And so on he went. And what I find interesting, and this again, this is in the book, is when he's deciding to run for the fourth term, he told Jim Farley, one of his close political confidants, that, you know, he was concerned about the New Deal, that now he's going to have to take his attention off these domestic reforms and work on the war. And so this is the election where he picks Henry Wallace to be his vice president, who is by far the most New Deal-ish of all his cabinet ministers. You know, Wallace was a former Republican. He did change to a Democrat later in the 30s, Secretary of Agriculture, but very committed to the ideas of the New Deal. And so, you know, Roosevelt says to Farley, and this is not widely known, a man like me could crack up at any moment. A man like me could die at any moment. And I think he was thinking about the posterity of the New Deal in 1940.
Oh, right.
And actually, in the book, not to give too much away, but there's an extraordinary conversation that Eleanor Roosevelt has just a few weeks before his death with a friend of hers named Margaret Fairweather. And she says, you know, they're talking about his health, and she's admitting how pitiful he looks. His hands are shaking. You know, he can't drive his car anymore. He's really declining, and everybody's worried about him. And she says, you know, but nevertheless, he knew when he made the decision to run, not in 1944, but in 1940, that it could shorten his life. But he decided to go on because he wanted to finish his work. And I agree with him. Mm. So an amazing conversation.
Well, it's an extraordinary thing when you think of a president taking his job seriously, in that he knows that if he doesn't do it, maybe there isn't someone to be able to do what he feels needs to be done.
Yeah.
I think many presidents, if they had the opportunity at this point to have a third term, you know, they'd leap at it. But of course, it's no longer possible. So, but as he goes into his fourth term, is he aware that he probably won't see the end of it? I mean, that's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, one of the things that comes out in the book is a couple of things. First of all, there is a kind of premonition that he has about his death. For example, he insists that Jim Roosevelt, his eldest son, James, come back for the inauguration. Well, James is a combat officer in the Philippines. And, you know, even though he's president, getting his son back is not going to be easy. And the reason he gets him back is partly because James had been at every one of his inaugurations. But the other reason is within minutes after finishing the oath of office, they go into his private study and Roosevelt brings up his will and tells James that he's going to be one of three executors of his will. And they have this conversation about his father's ring and everything else. And James kind of laughs it off and says, well, it's not going to happen anytime soon. But there are all these premonitions in the last months of his life that he articulates. He did know he was ill, I think. But, you know, his personality is such that he just kind of he's been doing this for 20 years because he had polio in 39 he just kind of goes on and jokes and you know, this ebullient nature of his personality. So we tend to think that these kinds of thoughts never crossed his mind, but in certain moments they did, and that comes out in the book.
Well, and it's a heavy thing to have the responsibility to realize that if you do die in office, then that's going to be tough on the country.
Yeah, and he has numerous conversations about where he wants to be buried with Frances Perkins. She's one of his closest confidants. She's the one who says that Roosevelt was a simple Christian. He defined himself as a Christian and a Democrat. And in one conversation, he explains that he wants to be buried at his home in Hyde Park in the Rose Garden.
Which is where he's buried.
Yes.
We'll be right back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show.
Waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me. Chakuru-de-la-la.
can I talk to you about Relief Factor?
Please do.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
I don't want you just to say that.
No, I'm not just saying that. Please.
I want you to take off. You're not my employee right now. Okay. You're just a friend. Can I talk to you about Relief Factor?
Please do.
Okay. Relief Factor is something that I take for pain. Okay? I have low-level pain. I'm not talking about searing, life-changing, horrible pain. Although, you know what? Now that I mention it, if you have low-level pain, like a 2 or a 3 on the scale of 1 to 10, I think it does change your life because you just do things differently. You're, you know. So I take Relief Factor, and I'm recommending it to my audience because if you're just taking it for granted that this is your new life, I would say don't. Relief Factor, these are botanicals. It's not like something toxic like Advil or whatever that's going to mess your liver if you mess up your liver if you take it over and over and over again. You can take this like crazy, and it's totally safe. ReliefFactor.com is the website, ReliefFactor.com. Get the quick start pack for $19.95. Within 3 weeks, you will know whether this works. I recommend it, folks. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Hey, folks, this is Eric Metaxas, and you know I believe America was founded as a beacon of liberty for the world. As I write in my book, If You Can Keep It, if we are to keep this republic, we have to see it afresh and really understand what it is we're keeping. If you have a heart for this important idea, I want to extend a personal invitation for you to join me at the 2018 Remember America Speaker Series on Friday, April 6th at 6:30 p.m. in Lancaster, Pennsylvania at the Lancaster County Convention Center. This event is sponsored by Dayspring Christian Academy and reminds us of our unique heritage of liberty that was founded upon biblical principles and calls us to let our light so shine for others to see. Join me for an inspirational night that brings a powerful message of hope with inspiring media, choral performances, and me, Eric Metaxas, at the Remember America Speaker Series. Tickets and sponsorships are available at dayspringchristian.com or call 717-344-5584. Visit dayspringchristian.com. That's dayspringchristian.com.
For young people who want to make the most of their summer, there's the Summer Academy at the King's College in New York City. At Summer Academy, inquisitive high schoolers learn how the great ideas of Western civilization apply to journalism, business, economics, and leadership, all from a biblical worldview. Plus, they'll enjoy world-famous landmarks and museums. One student called it the learning experience of a lifetime. To learn more, Google the King's College Summer Academy. That's the King's College Summer Academy.
For unhappy timeshare owners, getting out is important, and with maintenance bills taking a bite out of your savings, now is the right time to call Lone Star Transfer to improve your financial situation. They've helped over 5,000 people get out of their timeshares quickly, legally, and ethically with a 99% success rate and an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. Let them help you. Call toll-free 855-551-7066, 855-551-7066 for a no-obligation consultation or visit them online at LoneStarTransfer.com.
Network with thousands of Christian media professionals, ministry representatives, pastors, and business leaders at Proclaim 18, the NRB International Christian Media Convention, February 27th through March 2nd in Nashville, Tennessee. Hear speakers including Kay Arthur, Rick Warren, Eric Metaxas, Luis Palau, Joel Rosenberg, Jim Caviezel, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell, and dozens more. Gain valuable insights by attending one or more of the convention's 6 industry session tracks, where industry leaders will speak on digital media, radio, TV, church media, film and entertainment, and international ministry. Experience NRB's massive exposition, featuring tools and services to expand and enhance your organization, church, or ministry. From media and fundraising experts to publishers and tech companies, the exposition has what you're looking for. Also on the expo floor will be an exhibit from Museum of the Bible, Proclaim 18, February 27th through March 2nd. For all the details, visit nrbconvention.org.
The Eric Metaxas Show. We're talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or as we insiders call him, FDR. I'm talking to FDR scholar David Woolner. The book is The Last 100 Days. And I want to ask you, David, you know, did you discover anything new? In other words, anything when you're digging into his, you know, private papers or doctor's records of his last 100 days on the planet, anything that surprised you?
Well, there were many things that surprised me. One thing that has been known for a little while but is relatively unknown is the fact that one of the three doctors that examined him in March of 1944, there was a second examination in May of 1944. This was a guy named Dr. Leahy from Boston. And when July of 44 comes around, he starts thinking that Roosevelt's about ready to announce that he's going to run for a fourth term. So he calls Ross McIntyre, who was FDR's physician and surgeon general, who was an ear, nose, and throat specialist because Roosevelt had chronic sinus problems. And he tells McIntyre, who's the official doctor of the United States, that he's convinced that if Roosevelt runs again, he won't survive a fourth term. And he says, I hope you've told the president this, and you better tell him he's got to think about who he's going to pick for his vice president and so forth and so on, because he's, in my opinion, he won't survive. McIntyre insists that he has informed. We don't really know. There's no record of whether he actually told the president. We do know that Franklin Roosevelt knew he had a heart problem, I think he knew a good deal of detail about it. Leahy was so concerned about his own personal reputation that he went back to his secretary and dictated a signed and audited and witnessed memorandum recounting this conversation and saying, you know, in case the president died and somebody questioned his medical capability of not understanding that this was going to happen,
right.
He wanted to protect himself. And that stayed in his safe for 70 years. And
70 years.
So there's been a lot of recent revelations about FDR's health that contributed a good deal to the book. And then the other thing that was very interesting that I looked at probably more than anybody else was what I call his last mission. Roosevelt was very, very interested in the possibility of the establishment of a Jewish homeland. Again, the readers need to understand that the Palestine was under British control. It was a League of Nations mandate from 1922. And as the war clouds loomed on the horizon, the British made the decision in 1939, because there had been a lot of unrest between the Jews and the Arabs as Jewish immigration continued through the 20s and 30s. There were about 500,000 Jews in Palestine by the time the war broke out. And the British felt that they couldn't – and there was unrest and serious Arab revolt in 1936 and so forth. So because of the possibility of war, they decided to placate the Arab population by issuing a policy document that's called a white paper, in which they would restrict Jewish immigration to 10,000 people per year for the next 5 years, plus an additional 25,000 refugees. So a total maximum number of 75,000. And there were provisions in that document that made it clear that really what they were going to do was stop after that, that the Jewish population was going to be a permanent minority in an Arab-dominated area in Palestine. And Roosevelt was convinced this was wrong. And it's really the beginning of the U.S. focus on the Middle East. And everyone told him that he would never be able to do this. But as time went on, he started thinking more and more. You know, he had great confidence in himself, great confidence that he could talk people into things and in his own ability to in a sense, charm people. So he insists on going to see Ibn Saud after Yalta, the king of Saudi Arabia. And they have this extraordinary meeting at the Great Bitter Lake, which is part of the Suez Canal. On his way home from Yalta. And it's an amazing story because every one of his aides says, don't do this. The military situation is we can't afford trouble in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And yet he insists, and he even has maps drawn up because he wants to show the king, look, Palestine's a small place. It's not going to be a problem.
And Palestine was effectively made up by the British anyway, was it not?
Yeah, I mean it's a League of Nations mandate. In this First World War, the British issued what was called the Balfour Declaration, where they agreed to endorse the idea of a Jewish homeland and support the Zionist idea of it.
Yeah,
and Roosevelt, takes up this cause. And so one of the interesting things about the book is his really serious attempt to try to make this happen. And he is completely rebuffed by the king.
And why do you think that was part of his makeup, that he would care about that? You wouldn't expect a WASP at that time to care about the Jews.
Roosevelt, he's a president who believes in including the excluded. You know, he is the one who brings in great numbers of Jews into his administration. He's he you know, he is a man who I think was without prejudice against the Jews. He's very comfortable with Catholics. I mean, at one point, Frances Perkins in the book is describing his religious belief, and she says, you know, Protestant and Catholic, Protestant and Jew alike were, you know, he understood the religious aspirations mm-hmm. of all three of those religions mm-hmm. and was very comfortable with it. And he had a kind of simple faith himself. And so he felt that that was an important part of a person's makeup. Anyway, it's an amazing story because one of the things I do in the book is recount all these conversations, whether it's the military, the State Department, you know, the United States needs oil. There's all this concern about what's that going to mean in terms of our oil. And we're just beginning to have this relationship with the Arab world.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that there was a dawn of our relationship with the Middle East, it wasn't a thing
and this is really the beginning of it. And in spite of all of that opposition, he goes ahead. He is completely rebuffed, as everyone said he would be, and he calls it the one great failure of his career.
Well, it's not really a failure because we did get around to it a few years after his death.
That's true,
but he wanted it to happen before that.
You know, he meets with Rabbi Stephen Weiss in March after that meeting, and he says, "You know, I tried, but I completely failed. I tried to promote your cause, but I couldn't move this man."
I talk about Stephen Weiss in my Bonhoeffer book, and I had the privilege of knowing his grandson, who just passed away a couple of years ago. History is fascinating. We're going to be right back, folks. We're talking to the author of The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace, David Woolner. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Victoria Hurst. My family's company, the Hearst Corporation, publishes a magazine aimed at young women called Cosmopolitan. Nicknamed Cosmo, it contains pornography that hurts kids. I oppose this and have asked the Hearst Corporation Board of Directors many times to label Cosmopolitan adult material so that it cannot be sold to anyone under 18. But the company has refused to do it. So now I have a campaign called Cosmo Hurts Kids. I'm working with legislators, law enforcement, and community groups to have all U.S. states' material harmful to minors laws enforced against Cosmo so that it cannot be sold to your kids. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation says Cosmopolitan magazine contains pornography and is harmful to minors. American Psychological Association studies prove that early exposure to sexualization has significant negative mental health consequences for underage girls. My website is CosmoHurtsKids.com. CosmoHurtsKids.com.
You know, I'm not a genius about money. I love my credit cards, and they love me. I was using them as a source of income, and then I got behind in my payments, and creditors were calling. I figured I had a problem, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I heard about Trinity, so I called and talked to a counselor. In half an hour, we worked out a plan. Now I've got one easy monthly payment, a lower interest rate, and I'm getting out of debt.
If you're in an endless cycle of paying on credit card balances that never seem to go away, then get ready for a toll-free number that will put you on a path to financial recovery. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees and over-limit charges, reduce your interest, and possibly improve your credit score. You'll save thousands. If your debt has you down, we should talk. Call 1-800-990-6976. That's 1-800-990-6976. Call 1-800-990-6976.
Hey, folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. You know, when you're thinking of what music can I play with the subject of FDR, most people would say Helen Reddy. I think that's true. It could be untrue, but I think it's true. I'm talking to the author of The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. Just a few minutes left. We have to talk about Chapter 8 in the book, The Birth of the United Nations. I'm not a big fan of the United Nations these days, but I know that some decades ago, it really was thought to be the answer to a lot of our world problems. Where was Roosevelt with all this?
Well, you know, again, the famous visit of Winston Churchill to the White House shortly after Pearl Harbor. You know, Churchill, sort of without asking, kind of moves into the White House. You can imagine the scene. And actually, he brings all of his maps with him. And this is where we get the map room, by the way. The whole Situation Room was a result of this, because Roosevelt was impressed with how Churchill had all these maps and was tracking the war.
I had no idea.
And it was actually a coat closet.
I love this.
They turned it into a map room. Highly secret. Nobody could go in there. But
heck of a closet, must have been.
Yeah, it was a big closet. But anyway, the long and the short of it is Roosevelt came up with this idea that he wanted to create a coalition to fight the war now that the United States was in it. And he came up with the name, and he wanted people to sign a declaration committing themselves to the war. Not a declaration of war, because some countries, for example, in South and Central America, were not ready to fight the Germans, but maybe they could help economically and so forth. So they all agreed to sign a declarations by United Nations. And 26 nations signed it on the 1st of January 1942. And that was a sort of commitment that people made to the various countries.
Okay,
in the world.
So this is literally a month after we've leapt into the war.
Exactly. So the name of the coalition that fought the Nazis was the United Nations. And, you know, if you go back and read the newspapers, you can see United Nations forces did this, United Nations forces did that. We don't use that phrase. We always talk about the Allies.
Right.
But actually, it was the United Nations. And around about 1943, Roosevelt decided that he would, you know, he wanted to set up an international organization after the war. The first articulation of that goal is in the Atlantic Charter. That predates our involvement in the war. That's August 1941. So he's committed to this idea. And, you know, Roosevelt always was, I think, thinking of this struggle as a kind of inclusive struggle of the nations of the world against this monstrous evil of Nazism and Japanese militarism. And, of course, from Winston Churchill's perspective, it's much more about restoring British glory and the British Empire and so forth. I mean, Churchill was also dedicated to preserving democracy, but he certainly didn't want to give up on the British Empire.
Right.
These things were sort of antithetical, of course, to Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Anyway, the long and the short of it is, as the war progresses, then he decides that they start referring to the United Nations organization, which is doing things like providing food relief and so forth.
Right.
And that's really an extension of the alliance. But eventually it becomes the idea that they would call it the United Nations organization. Now, what's important to remember about this is that Roosevelt lived through the Wilson administration years. You know, he was assistant secretary of the Navy under President Wilson. He saw the failure of the League of Nations. And he understood that you needed great power cooperation if you're going to make something like this work. So really, the United Nations is comprised of two things: the Security Council, where you get the big powers together in the same room, and then the General Assembly, where you deal with social and economic problems.
It's horrifying to be out of time. We're out of time. Thank you, David Woolner. The book is The Last 100 Days. Congratulations.
Thank you, Eric. It's been my pleasure.
Folks, sorry to be out of time. Fascinating subject. Grab the book, The Last 100 Days.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.